First of all, I love America. I love the Constitution. I love the First Amendment. I want to carry and own us. I love property. And let me tell you something. If you care about your country, I'll read Ludwig von Mises and the Six Lessons of the Austrian Economic School.
And that's a Moicano, ladies and gentlemen. Killing it out here.
I'd have to agree. That's some pretty sage advice. I think it's time for a Bitcoin Audible read. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy your Bitcoin. And do not forget, right now, the first and or the next $10,000 worth of Bitcoin that you buy on Swan is no fees at all. You can literally get set up in minutes and start buying your first Bitcoin. Check them out. Go to the Swan app. And of course, you're going to want to keep it safe. Get a cold card. And in fact, they're having a halving discount, which I didn't even realize until I went to the website today. But if this actually gets published before the halving happens, catch it quickly, because they've got like 20% off everything in the store. So if it is not yet block 840,000, I gave you very, very little time to take advantage of it. I apologize. But otherwise, my discount is still there, and it will continue to work. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, and it's right there in the show notes. So today, if you heard the clip from Renato Moicano, the UFC fighter, who randomly, I thought it was AI when somebody posted it. I was like, oh, this is actually pretty good. Sure enough, he actually said that, and it has blown up. There's a lot of interest on Mises and Mises.org. They've sold out of their books. In fact, the article by Newman here that we were about to read basically just goes over the summary version of what it is, what the original work is, and then what was originally what became known as Mises's Six Lessons in Brazil in the translated version of it. And he goes into what the six lessons are. And if you want a simple Austrian economic foundation, if you want to understand the kind of underlying principles that inform all of the perspective from the Austrian school, we hit a simple summary with this, which I didn't remember who it was, but Michael Matliff, shout out, thanks, dude. And again, great hanging out, man. Hopefully I catch up with you in Nashville. But he actually shared this out, so I had not even seen this. But I think this is a great one to hit simply because, A, it's popular right now, and B, like, if you don't know what it is, like, I think this is a very, very worthwhile piece. This is a critical topic, because if you don't understand the Austrian School of Economics and the kind of foundational monetary theory and market theory ideas laid out by Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, like all of these people, then you literally don't, you're missing the first principles foundation for understanding why a sound money is going to produce an phenomenally better society. And axiomatically so. It just means that society is able to communicate and grow. And if you had to start anywhere, Mises' Six Lessons isn't a bad start. So without further ado, let's get into the short article and then a guy's take to follow. And it's titled, What Are Mises' Six Lessons? By Jonathan Newman. Ludwig von Mises' economic policy, Thoughts for Today and Tomorrow, has become quite popular recently. The Mises bookstore has sold out of its physical copies, and the PDF, which is available online for free, has seen over 50,000 downloads in the past few days. This surge in interest in Mises' ideas was started by UFC fighter Renato Moicano, who declared in a short post-fight victory speech, I love America, I love the Constitution, I want to carry guns, I love private property. Let me tell you something, if you care about your country, read Ludwig von Mises and the Six Lessons of the Austrian Economic School. The Six Lessons he is referring to is Mises' book, Economic Policy, Thoughts for Today and Tomorrow, which was republished by our friends in Brazil under the title as Seis Lecciones, The Six Lessons. If you are interested in what Mises has to say in this book, which is a transcription of lectures he gave in Argentina in 1959, here's a brief preview, which I hope inspires you to read the short book in full. As a side note, if you are an undergraduate student who is interested in these ideas, the Mises Institute's next Mises Book Club is on this text. Pure coincidence. Lecture 1. Capitalism. Mises begins his first lecture with an overview of the development of capitalism out of feudalism. Businesses began, quote, mass production to satisfy the needs of the masses, instead of focusing on producing luxury goods for the elite. These big businesses succeeded because they served the needs of a larger group of people, and their success wholly depended on their ability to give this mass of consumers what they wanted. Despite the amazing and undeniable increases in standards of living, even for a growing population, capitalism had its detractors, including Karl Marx, who gave capitalism its name. Mises says that while Marx hated capitalism, and that Marx dubbed it thusly as an attack on the system, the name is a good one. Quote, because it describes clearly the source of the great social improvements brought about by capitalism. Those improvements are the result of capital accumulation. They are based on the fact that people, as a rule, do not consume everything they have produced, that they save and invest a part of it. Prosperity is the result of providing for the future. More precisely, it is the result of setting aside consumption today by saving and investing resources in production. Mises says that this principle explains why some countries are more prosperous than others. When it comes to economic growth, quote, there are no miracles. There is only the application of the principles of the free market economy, of the methods of capitalism. Lecture 2. Socialism. In the second lecture, Mises takes a closer look at Marx's proposed system, socialism. Economic freedom means that people can choose their own careers and use their resources to accomplish their own needs. Economic freedom is the basis for all other freedoms. For example, when the government seizes whole industries, like that of the printing press, it determines what will be published and what won't, and the freedom of the press disappears. Mises acknowledges that there is no such thing as perfect freedom in a metaphysical sense. We must obey the laws of nature, especially if we intend to use and transform nature according to our ends. And even economic freedom means that there is a fundamental interdependence among individuals. Quote, freedom in society means that a man depends as much on other people as other people depend upon him. This is also true for big business and the entrepreneurs who lead them. The true, quote, bosses in the market economy are not those who shout orders to the workers, but the consumers. Socialists despise the idea of consumer sovereignty because it means allowing mistakes. In their mind, the state should play the paternalistic role of deciding what is good for everyone. Thus, Mises sees no difference between socialism and a system of slavery. Quote, the slave must do what his superior orders him to do, but the free citizen, and this is what freedom means, is in a position to choose his own way of life. In capitalism, this freedom makes it possible for people to be born into poverty but then achieve great success as they provide for their fellow man. This kind of social mobility is impossible under systems like feudalism and socialism. Mises ends this lecture with a short explanation of the economic calculation critique of socialism. When the private ownership of the means of production is prohibited, then economic calculation is made impossible. Without market prices for factors, we cannot economize production and provide for the needs of the masses, no matter who oversees the socialist planning board. The result is mass deprivation and chaos. Lecture 3. Interventionism. Interventionism describes a situation in which the government, quote, wants to interfere with market phenomena. each intervention involves an abrogation of the consumer sovereignty Mises had explained in the two previous lectures. Quote, the government wants to interfere in order to force businessmen to conduct their affairs in a different way than they would have chosen if they had obeyed only the consumers. Thus, all the measures of interventionism by the government are directed toward restricting the supremacy of consumers. Mises gives an example of a price ceiling on milk. While those who enact such an intervention may intend to make milk more affordable for poorer families, there are many unintended consequences: increased demand, decreased supply, non-price rationing in the form of long queues at shops that sell milk, and importantly, grounds for the government to intervene in new ways now that their initial intervention has not achieved its intended purpose. So in Mises' example, he traces through the new interventions like government rationing, price controls for cattle food, price controls for luxury goods, and so on, until the government has intervened in virtually every part of the economy. In other words, socialism. After providing some historical examples of this process, Mises gives the big picture. Interventionism, as a middle-of-the-road policy, quote-unquote, is actually a road toward totalitarianism. Lecture 4. Inflation. Quote, there can be no secret way to the solution of the financial problems of a government. If it needs money, it has to obtain the money by taxing its citizens, or under special conditions, by borrowing it from people who have the money. But many governments, we can even say most governments, think there is another method for getting the needed money: simply to print it. If the government taxes citizens to build a new hospital, then the citizens are forced to reduce their spending and the government, quote, replaces their spending with its own. If, however, the government uses newly printed money to finance the construction of the hospital, then there is no replacement of spending, but an addition, end quote, prices will tend to go up. Mises, per usual, explodes the idea of a, quote, price level that rises and falls, as if all prices change simultaneously and proportionally. Instead, prices rise step by step. The first receivers of new money increase their demand for goods, which provides new income to those who sell those goods. Those sellers may now increase their demands for goods. This explains the process by which some prices and some people's incomes increase before others. The result is a price revolution, in which prices and incomes rise in a stepwise fashion, starting with the origin of the new money. In this way, new money alters the distribution of incomes and the arrangement of real resources throughout the economy, creating, quote, winners and losers. The gold standard offers a strict check against the inflationist tendencies of governments. In such a system, the government cannot create new units of money to finance its spending, so it must resort to taxation, which is notably unpopular. Fiat inflation, however, is subtle, and its effects are complex and delayed, which makes it especially attractive to governments that can wield it. In this lecture, Mises also executes a thorough smackdown of Keynes and Keynesianism, but I'll leave that for readers to enjoy. Lecture 5. Foreign Investment. Mises returns to a principle he introduced in the first lecture, that economic growth stems from capital accumulation. The differences in standards of living between countries is not attributable to technology, the qualities of the workers, or the skills of the entrepreneurs, but to the availability of capital. One way that capital may be accumulated within a country is through foreign investment. The British, for example, provided much of the capital that was required to develop the rail system in the United States and in Europe. This provided mutual benefit for both the British and the countries on the receiving end of this investment. The British earned profits through their ownership of the rail systems, and the receiving countries, even with a temporary, quote, unfavorable balance of trade, obtained the benefits of the rail system, including expanded productivity, which over time allowed them to purchase stock in the rail companies from the British. Foreign investment allows the capital accumulation in one country to speed up the development of other countries, all without a one-sided sacrifice on the part of the country providing the investment. Wars, especially world wars, protectionism, and domestic taxation destroyed this mutually beneficial process. When countries impose tariffs or expropriate the capital that belongs to foreign investors, they, quote, prevent or to slow down the accumulation of domestic capital and to put obstacles in the way of foreign capital. Lecture 6, Politics and Ideas. The classical liberal ideas of the philosophers of the 18th and early 19th centuries helped create the constrained governments and economic freedom that led to the explosion of economic growth Mises discussed in the first lecture. But the emergence of minority, quote, pressure groups, what we would call special interest groups today, directed politicians away from classical liberal ideas and toward interventionism. The groups that would benefit from various interventions lobby the government to grant them favors like monopoly privileges, taxes on competition, including tariffs, and subsidies. And as we have seen, this interventionist spiral tends toward socialism and totalitarianism. The, quote, resurgence of the warlike spirit in the 20th century brought about world wars and exacerbated the totalitarian trends even in the once exemplary nations. The concomitant rise in government expenditures made fiat money and inflation too tempting. The wars and special projects advocated by the pressure groups were expensive, and so budget constraints were discarded in favor of debasement. This, Mises says, explains the downfall of civilization. He points to the Roman Empire as an example. Quote, what had taken place? What was the problem? What was it that caused the disintegration of an empire which, in every regard, had attained the highest civilization ever achieved before the 19th century? The truth is that what destroyed this ancient civilization was something similar, almost identical, to the dangers that threaten our civilization today. On the one hand, it was interventionism, and on the other hand, inflation. Mises finds hope in the fact that the detractors of economic freedom, like Marx and Keynes, do not represent the masses or even a majority. Marx, for example, quote, was not a man from the proletariat. He was the son of a lawyer. He was supported by his friend Friedrich Engels, who, being a manufacturer, was the worst type of bourgeois, according to socialist ideas. In the language of Marxism, he was an exploiter. This implies that the fate of civilization depends on a battle of ideas, and Mises thought that good ideas would win. Quote, I consider it as a very good sign that while 50 years ago practically nobody in the world had the courage to say anything in favor of a free economy, we have now, at least in some of the advanced countries of the world, institutions that are centers for the propagation of a free economy. May we continue Mises' project and fulfill his hope. What the world needs is, quote, Minus Marx, Mais Mises. This episode is brought to you by the Cold Card hardware wallet made by CoinKite. So just a minute ago, I was paying my producer, Johnny, for the incredible work that he does. Shout out, Johnny, if you actually listen to this. A huge thank you to him for all of the stuff he does to keep this thing running. But I just paid for this month's invoice for the work he has performed for me. And I did it with my Cold Card and my Nunchuck wallet on my phone. So my hardware wallet, my Cold Card, is completely separate from my phone, from my device. And I have a simple multi-sig. And whenever I need to pay, I mean, I do this while I'm just sitting here doing other stuff. I'm recording the episode or something. I'm like, ah, crap, I need to get back to that invoice. And I bring it up, I get the QR code, I scan it with my wallet, and then it asks me to sign. And I literally get out, plug in my Cold Card, hit ready to sign, and then I tap it to my phone to get the transaction. I sign it, I tap it back to my phone to send the transaction, and then I hit OK on my wallet, or broadcast, I think. That's it. My keys are completely separate from my phone. If I lost my phone, I'm fine. If my phone gets hacked or I'm using malicious software, I am also fine. My cold card protects me, and yet it is easy to access, easy to use. In my opinion, there is no more important piece of your Bitcoin stack, of being in Bitcoin, than having yourself a secure, reliable hardware wallet. If you haven't checked them out yet, you need to, and there is a link directly to their store if you want to check it out, and also my discount code, Bitcoin Audible, all one word. Details and discount and everything will be available right in the description of this episode. If you have not yet secured your keys, do it. Check out CoinGuide. All right. So that was a great short article and kind of introduction to these ideas. And it might be worth doing the PDF at length, or digging into maybe one of the lectures slowly over time on this show. But there's a few things that stood out to me. So it's been really interesting to see, like, there is clearly a cultural and mental shift happening. It's crazy. The number of people, for so long, it's been kind of beaten into our heads that the problems of today are a problem, are problems resulting from capitalism. And it could not be further from the truth. It's so blatantly clear that we don't have it. But only if you are aware of how some of the key elements of our system works. And understand that without prices, without an open pricing system, and without an independent monetary system to guide those prices as a foundation for actually exchanging and understanding value between each other, intersubjectively, between people, without it, you don't have a free market. You don't have a price system. You don't have anything that's actually transmitting genuine economic information and value judgments through the economy. And every single time you debase or you twist, you manipulate, you subsidize, you tax, you inflate and print money, you issue new debt backed by nothing, every time you manipulate the accounting ledger, all you actually do is dilute the economic information. It's just like poison in your food. It's no longer doing the job that it needs to do. And one of the things that I find really interesting is, you know, he brings up in describing the first lecture about feudalism and how capitalism essentially overturned it. And what occurred is, like, under feudalism, you have this political and social control. You have political and social authority that is dictating where and how the resources move through society. Who has access to what capital? And because of that, you do not have the people in society able to build up capital. And there's a great thread by Devin Erickson, the author of Theft of Fire, a really fantastic fiction sci-fi book. And he's a stark, aggressively against communist and socialist ideals. And he has these fantastic threads on Twitter about, you know, just like kind of hitting some idea or some comment that somebody makes and just like piece by piece blasting through it, just kind of destroying the idea. And is essentially from first principles is kind of how his whole positioning is. And it's fantastic. I read them very regularly. In fact, for anybody who doesn't know, he was actually on this show. I had a conversation with him, not even just somewhat about his book, because I was a big fan of the book, but also just about his threads and his perspective and, you know, kind of his background that led him there and how he sees the change in storytelling and kind of where we are in a cultural shift. So it's a really, really fun conversation. It's called Being Right Too Early with Devin Erickson. It was chat 90. I'll have the link in the show notes so you can check it out. But one of the threads that I really enjoyed of his was that the entire purpose, the creation of society, is the ability to protect capital investment. That's it. They are one and the same. And it's actually extremely simple and intuitive to understand why. So let's say we are hunter-gatherers and we have no tools or anything. We don't really utilize anything other than, you know, we pick up a rock and we'll use it from time to time. We don't have any capital, which means there's no production machines. There's no tools that we trade or engage in for the purpose of then using it to produce or using it to hunt. And that's the key. Capital is essentially that investment, that time, that cost, that mental energy and physical energy that we put into obtaining something simply to make the process of production or the process of making food or the shelter or whatever it is easier, to improve the process of acquiring the thing. So we explicitly turn down actions or time or energy to actually acquire the thing, and instead use that time, energy, and, you know, mental capacity to change the mode of interaction so that when we go back to acquiring the thing that we want, we can do so more efficiently. We can do so in a greater capacity. But that's a huge trade-off. That's a huge risk. I mean, imagine you're in a world where you don't have any tools, you don't have any trade, and you're taking 3 days off from eating to make a tool or a bow and arrow or something, so in the hopes of, because you just have an idea that you have never tested before, that you could make something that would make it easier to hunt. That is a massive risk. That is a huge risk. So now imagine you take the time, you take 2 days, 3 days, you don't eat, and you don't hunt, and you stay and you carve a bow. Or you try a couple of different things, and, you know, the first couple don't work. You try to do an arrow, or you just make a spear, whatever it is. You spend this time, this investment, in trying to make this tool in order to make your hunting more efficient. Then somebody comes along and hits you in the back of the head and steals it. Well, that's it. You're never going to make another one of those things. Not unless you have some way to protect your investment so that you can actually make it. And the other guy isn't going to make any more of them because A, he doesn't know how, or B, if he can't protect his investment either, if you don't have the technology, if you don't have the capacity to protect the investment, no one invests. No one makes anything, and you simply have no capital goods. No one is going to starve so that someone else can eat the cost that they bore. And what's funny is if he is able to keep that, if he's able to protect that investment, the entire society actually gets better. The entire thing gets more productive because he's now encouraged to keep doing this, to make this for other people. And his productive capacity in hunting is going to increase dramatically. And as he can create, as he can obtain more than he was able to before, and specifically obtain more than he is able to use himself, that is when specialization occurs and you can now trade with other people. The thief, on the other hand, is explicitly destroying the ability to save, to protect that investment, is punishing the person who took the risk to make that investment, which makes them even less likely to do it going forward. And so he specifically enriches himself at the cost of allowing that to make society better. And without any cultural or societal basis for protecting that investment, then it's just going to go through a chain of the next guy coming along and beating him on the back of the head, and then the next guy, and then the next guy, until just basically the most socially or violently powerful person is the only one who has it, until it breaks, and then we have nothing again. The protection of private property and investment in private capital is the task of society in order to keep itself alive. Money is one of the most important tools for doing exactly that. It is a way to establish a set of rules that allow the access to other people's property, to other people's production and value and resources added into the economy. That access, it has a very explicit and strict set of rules where only people who have participated, only people who have voluntarily added resources in, can actually take out the comparative same amount of resources. So going back to the notion of feudalism, is that you're looking at a system of social and political power where the powerful simply, everyone simply works for the feudal lords because the feudal lords simply own everything that occurs. And because of that, you specifically don't have wealth because nobody underneath the feudal hierarchy in the, you know, the special class, whatever you call it, in the wealthy elite, have anything and can essentially obtain anything of significant value, can make any investment, and thus they don't actually have the capacity to work and trade for each other. They work for the feudal lord, and those who wish to gain more favor attempt to serve the feudal lord in some additional capacity. Now, the free market, the opening of the market and the ability for everyone to obtain property and obtain capital and to invest in productive capacity allowed anyone to freely associate. You didn't have to go through a feudal lord. You didn't have to have the government approve your transaction or, you know, force you to get a license, like give you permission to make an exchange. It's just freedom. Like if you and some other person not harming each other, and you want to voluntarily agree to do something, to make some sort of a trade, you can. You're free. We so clearly don't have that market. Like, in a million different ways, we don't have that market. But here's the interesting thing, is that what we switched from actually wasn't, or what we have today, is not free markets versus feudalism back in the day. What we had was feudalism through a power hierarchy that was social and political, and now we have feudalism through a monetary hierarchy, a power hierarchy that is built around the access and the control over the monetary ledger and the monetary rules. And I'll explain why with a simple analogy. Is going back, and I use this analogy a lot because I think it illustrates very, very well what's going on. You have 10 people in society. A free market is everybody does their part and they trade for money, and nobody can actually print any more money. The money just is, and anybody who has money therefore has traded with someone else. So each person in this 10-person society does a job, right? One person makes the cars, one person gets the fuel, one person builds the houses, one person gets the food, one person gets the water, et cetera, et cetera. They each have their individual jobs and they all trade in relative terms what the value of each thing is. So the guy who built the houses can only take out so many cars, food, fuel, all of that stuff based on the value of the house to everyone else in the society. And same with all other players. Now imagine that only 9 of them are working and one of them is actually printing money. How does that change the dynamic? Well, rather than having prices that then reflect the comparative demand and the comparative cost that each person is willing to bore in what they do and what they provide. Basically, how many sandwiches is Tommy willing to put into the economy in order to get a house? The only reason we know anything about the value of the house is because he bears the cost of taking the time, making all of the food, and feeding those other people explicitly by not feeding himself, by not consuming for himself. He is doing favors for other people. So he knows what it took to get that house. And therefore, he is the only one who knows what that house is worth. And same for anybody else who is working. That's the only reason we actually have a liquid enough market to begin to create a price system against all these things. Value is only relative. Value is only relative. The iPhone 1 in 1990 is one of the most valuable pieces of technology on the face of the planet. The iPhone 1 today is worth next to nothing. Why? Because of alternatives. Value is relative to what is available. Today, the iPhone 1 is worthless because everything is better than an iPhone 1. In 1990, an iPhone is the most important piece of technology in the world because nothing can do what the iPhone 1 can do. The only reason that value is transmitted into the market is because each person feels they actually live the cost, live the work that they had to do to get the money, the favors and benefit and trade that they had to do with someone else in order to get the money. that then is the weight that allows them to make the decision to compare it to what it is that they can achieve, to what it is they are trying to trade for. The only reason I know that it's worth it to go to a movie and enjoy myself for 2 hours with my wife or family is because I'm down here doing the requisite work to know what it means to try to get that amount of money. So the person in our 10-person society who is printing the money now is just able to get everybody else's stuff for free, for nothing. He doesn't contribute. There's no weight behind any of his decisions. What's a, you know, if you had $1 million today that you earned, that you worked your ass off, you would never, ever, ever spend it in the same way as if somebody just conjured $1 million or $1 billion in your bank account. $1 million would be meaningless to you. You'd go out and you'd just blow it at a club. There would be no economic value weight behind it whatsoever because you have no idea what $1 million is worth. You have no idea what it cost to achieve that $1 million. This is why every single lottery winner, every last one of them who wins a lump sum lottery ticket, is either broke or millions of dollars in debt, basically at the end of a year. None of them. Statistically, if you just look at what happens, winning a lottery is basically the worst thing that could happen to you. So going back to the idea of feudalism, of free markets. So feudalism doesn't work, and or it leads to deprivation and poverty because there is none of this free market signal. There is none of this weight. There's none of this genuine economic communication that allows the society and trade and production to thrive, to just explode. Because every little piece, every new transaction, every new trade adds more value density to what is happening in the economy. And it signals more and more the precise thing that some additional person could engage in to add more value somewhere. And it becomes this feedback loop, this economic engine that fuels itself to continue to grow and get better and improve endlessly. But we have an economy where one dude is just printing money and he buys up the houses, he buys up the cars, he uses up all the fuel, he eats all the food, and everyone else doesn't. I mean, think about it, like Tommy spends a year building a house. And obviously you only want him to be able to trade it with the guy who made 3 cars, made a bunch of food, got a bunch of water for everybody. You want someone to have produced a requisite amount of value into the economic engine. And then you're going to have a very serious restraint on the price because that other guy, let's call him Dan, is not going to be frivolous about what he is spending. There's going to be a very tight and highly concerned and very important judgment that both people are making about what it is worth to give up in order to have the house and in order for the house to, and in order to decide how many other resources to leave, to give up the house for. But when number 10, when Ben is over there printing money, he just buys up the house and he buys up the cars. And now literally the guy who made the house and the guy who made the cars, there's no cars or houses available for them. They are poor, and they got the money from Dan. And Dan's not, I mean, excuse me, from Ben. And Ben's not going to sell because he printed the money because he wanted something. The money is literally worthless to him. There was no cost to getting it. The only thing you want is the stuff. The money is just access to stuff. He's not going to eat the money. He's not going to live inside the money. He's not going to drive the money to work. So what happens to that economic system? How does it start to rearrange? So now we got Tommy, who used to build houses that he thought he could sell to Dan and to Sarah and to the other 9 people who are actually contributing in the economy. But you know what? Ben has lots of money. Maybe he can just build a giant luxury house for Ben instead. And you know, Dan was going to build affordable, modular, easy to work on cars for everyone else, for the other 9 people who contribute and know what the value of their money is. He was going to build for them because he needed to. They were the only ones who were contributing and who had money. But now Ben has lots of money. Maybe he'll just make obnoxious luxury cars for Ben. And Sarah, instead of cooking food and stuff for everybody in the real economy, decides she's going to make caviar and make an absurdly up-class restaurant for Ben. And they all just can't believe Ben pays the best. And what do you end up with? You have half of society working for Ben. All doing things that nobody needs and nobody wants. And you have the appearance of wealth. Because the technology can still get better. The amount of improvements, everything that can happen, can still accelerate, can still improve, can still benefit. Production can expand. But it's all for the counterfeit class. It's all for Ben. And everybody just joins into Ben's club. Here's the interesting thing. It's feudalism again. You're not working for the other consumer. Society, the people in society are no longer working for each other. They are working for the money printer. This is how you have the wealthiest society in the world with a massive, massive homeless problem, with a staggering poverty problem, with inner cities that are disgusting and literally rotten to the core. Because an enormous amount of the economy doesn't have to care anymore. Because resources are not distributed in anything related to who is actually putting resources in, who's actually providing the value for the economy. And think about what potent nihilism, hate, divisiveness, bitterness that creates in the people. When they see that the wealthiest in society don't do shit. They don't do anything productive. In fact, their whole game is to play the political favor and the game of blackmail and embarrassment and cheating that goes on in the counterfeit class and the political sphere. That's what they do. They're good at playing a game funded by the defrauding of society. All of the slaves work to contribute the funds to this game, the resources, the blood, sweat, and tears that go into all of the stuff we make in society, and they contribute to this game. And then the counterfeit and political class play a game of politics. They play a game of social favor, of lying, cheating, stealing, of convincing the exhausted, distracted masses that this is the bad guy, this is the person you should fund, this is the project we need. And holy crap, they get good at that game. They play this social game to use all of those funds and resources for their endeavors, contributed by the monetary slaves. What we have today is feudalism through a monetary system rather than feudalism through a political system. If the markets don't direct the resources and do not guide the pricing system to understand and translate the value of the things in the society, it's not a free market. It's just not. It's got nothing that makes it meaningful and would actually make it work. It's just slavery with extra steps. We all work for the money printer instead of each other. So anyway, I thought this was a great piece. And I think it was one of the Audionauts. Was it Michael or RD? Who was it that recommended this? Hold on a second. Let me give a shout out. Oh yeah, Michael Matliff. What's up, boss? So he shared this on Keat, in the Keat room. And then Clarkian also recommended a good one that we might be reading soon as well. So shout out Clarkian for the suggestions as well. So in fact, this is a good time to remind you that I do a lot of my reading, or I find a lot of my articles and a lot of the stuff that I cover through suggestions. So I am more than happy. I very much welcome any and all suggestions, articles that you liked, or specifically that you want to hear because you don't have the time to read that crap. That's what I'm here for. And it is a great way to help me filter it out because I have to go through a lot of stuff and I very often don't get to read it all. That's not very often a lie. I never get to read it all. There is always more to read than I can. So suggestions are much appreciated. And thank you all for supporting the show. A thank you to Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite for also being supporters of the show, for sponsoring, and for just having awesome services and products for the Bitcoiners in this space. I was a avid supporter and user of both long before they were supporting this show. And honestly, I gotta say, I'm pretty lucky to be able to work with just companies that I like and know personally to keep this show alive, keep Bitcoin working for you guys. So thank you all so much, and I will catch you on the next episode. Until then, take it easy, guys. He who is unfit to serve his fellow citizen wants to rule them. Ludwig von Mises.